Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure today to introduce Patrick Iver, lecturer at Stanford University on Latin American history, and he'll be speaking on what is the purpose of democracy. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I'm very pleased to be here with you this evening. Last month, I was reading the newspaper, and I happened across two articles that caught my attention. In one case, the author was making a case for the defense of a form of national health care on the grounds of fairness and equality, and noted that the program was being, rather hysterically, attacked by its opponents as socialism. In the second case, the author of the article was focused on the abuse of the filibuster in the Senate to block a majority of votes from implementing a progressive program. All of this should sound quite familiar, of course, but the catch is that my work is an historian, and in both cases, the newspaper articles were from 1948. The vote that was being blocked by the filibuster was the elimination of poll taxes in the South, which were being used, of course, to deny the franchise to black voters. And the fact that we're dealing with the same problems of structure today suggests to me that Max Weber was right to call politics a strong and slow boring of hard boards, and that the form in which our particular democracy takes to protect the privileges of the propertied and the original purpose of those counter-majoritarian features of our government ought not to be celebrated as the actions of genius by the unruly and disagreeable band of 18th century politicians that we revere as founders. Still, poll taxes are now unconstitutional, change is not impossible, and the idea of democracy continues to inspire both critics and those who wish to change the world. Indeed, there are few words with which every politician would wish to be associated. Democracy is one of them. Especially since World War II, even the most improbable regimes, like the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, claim the title. At its most basic level, it rests on the idea that sovereignty resides with the people, an idea which can be much abused. In self-justification, if never in practice, a single ruler could claim to incarnate and perfectly represent the wishes of the people, and is thus democratic, though not in the way that we would understand it in this country, where we define democracy as involving the balance of powers and assume that it takes place in a liberal public sphere between contending powers, and where periodic elections of representatives are supposed to form a kind of second-best approximation of what people want, given that people want different and often incompatible things. Where it is absent, democracy is a thrilling and beguiling prospect, and yet where it is achieved, it is almost inevitably disappointing. Even in the United States, where almost no one would admit that they harbor secret anti-democratic fantasies, approval ratings of Congress last February fell so low that Americans approved of some of the following things at higher levels than they did of Congress. BP after the oil spill, Paris Hilton, the Internal Revenue Service, and even Nixon during Watergate. Even the idea of the U.S. going communist was approved of by 11% of the public, whereas only 9% approved of the job that Congress was doing. There is a deep dissatisfaction with the quality of government that democracy has delivered, and the U.S. is not alone in this sentiment. Dissatisfaction and disillusionment and in the performance of democracy are widespread. Every 12 years, our four-year presidential cycle coincides with Mexico's six-year presidential cycle, and for professional reasons, I've had the opportunity to witness both elections up close this year. So I'd like to divide the rest of my talk into three short parts. In the first, I'll take a talk about the state of democracy in Mexico with respect to its the election that took place over the summer. In the second, I'll talk about the election here in the United States, which is with as much clarity as the rapidly shifting sands of the 24-hour news cycle will allow. And finally, I'd like to step back and look at some of the philosophical underpinnings of democratic ideas and suggest some ways that we may be able to deal with the disappointment that we feel with actually existing democracies. So let's begin with Mexico. Mexico's history with electoral democracy is still very short. For a bit over 70 years, most of the 20th century, from the late 1920s until 2000, its presidents all came from a single party, though that party remade itself twice during that span, eventually settling on the paradoxical name of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI for its initials in Spanish. Every 6 years, without possibility of re-election, a successor was chosen, supported by the party and duly elected. Occasionally, there were challenges from either the left or the right, but the PRI was adept at earning real support. It was also adept at trucking in sort of real support. And in a pinch, it was quite good at concocting the result. Presidents moved from right to left ideologically in their approaches and their policies, but the party held on to power decade after decade, earning the moniker of the perfect dictatorship, most famously from the Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, because it chose its new dictator every 6 years. Vargas Llosa, incidentally, after he made that statement in a public forum in Mexico, quickly left the country. Without getting into the entire history, Mexico has had a right-wing party of long standing, known as the PAN, the P-A-N, with especially strong support in the industrialized north of the country. In 1989, Mexico acquired a left-wing party known as the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, formed by many former members of the ruling PRI and other parties of the left. In presidential elections of 1988, a left-wing challenger was doing so well that the PRI resorted to massive fraud to ensure its victory. The PRD remains stronger in the south of the country and also in Mexico City. So there are three major parties, unlike the United States where we have two major parties, and they divide the country roughly in three parts depending on the election. Finally, in 2000, a candidate from the conservative PAN, who talked like a moderate and earned votes from the left-wing PRD, who seized the chance to help dislodge the PRI from the presidency, won. 6 years later, the candidate of the PAN defeated the candidate of the left-wing PRD by less than half a percentage point. That was the 2006 election, the one prior to this year's election. That year, the PRI did not win a plurality in any single state. They all either went to the left-wing party or the right-wing party. So this year, the presidential campaign featured three major candidates and a fourth candidate who deserves a bit of attention. The PRI's candidate, the eventual victor, as you may know, was a man named Enrique Peña Nieto, a young former governor with a handsome face and a soap opera actress for a wife. The candidate of the right-wing PAN was, for the first time, a woman, Josefina Vázquez Mota, whose campaign was hindered by both her lack of charisma, but more importantly by the weight of the party's incumbent president's, policies. There'd been a dramatic increase in violence, as you're probably aware, over the course of his presidency because of the ways that he had chosen to deal with the particular problems of Mexico's gangs and drug traffickers. The candidate of the left, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was a successful former mayor of Mexico City, but also the man who had narrowly lost the election in 2006. He had never accepted that result, declaring that a mafia of power was keeping him from the presidency, but unfortunately never produced any evidence of fraud. Even within the left, he was a divisive figure, seen by many as too much of an old populist and with a dubious commitment to the rules of electoral democracy. Mexican campaigns, unlike those in the United States, are limited by law to a few months before the ballots are cast. So this year's events unfolded very quickly. From the earliest polling, Peña Nieto had an edge. He had been the unofficial favorite for quite some time. He enjoyed favorable coverage from the dominant TV network in Mexico, Televisa, which used to work hand in glove with the PRI in its more authoritarian years, as well as the number two network, TV Azteca. He was the prohibitive favorite. López Obrador of the left-wing PRD was considered damaged by his past behavior, and his TV appearances were often listless, but he mobilized people in the streets very successfully and indeed was the only major party candidate who increased his vote share from the first polls to the final tally. So in a way, you could say he won the campaign, even though he didn't win the election. The more people saw of the PAN's Vázquez Mota, the fewer votes were pledged to her. There was also, unfortunately, a fourth candidate representing one of the worst features of Mexican democracy, running as the representative of the phenomenally corrupt and retrograde party of the Teachers Union. He was actually, in some ways, the best candidate. Sharp in the debates, running on a kind of libertarian platform of free markets and drug legalization, plus environmentalism. He's an environmental engineer by trade. He ended up with only about 2% of the vote, but it was enough for his party to keep its registration, which is something that it sorely deserved to lose. Peña Nieto had many critics during the course of his campaign. Working from a script, he talked about a new PRI, about respect for democracy, about putting more money in people's pockets, and so on. Off script, he often seemed lost, like little more than the pretty face that he undoubtedly has. At Mexico's most important book fair, for example, he was asked what books he liked to read and said, "I have read a number of books, starting with novels that I have liked. misidentify the author of one of the novels he said he liked, and then fell back on the Bible as the book that he liked. At an event at an elite private university in Mexico City, he was greeted by angry students who questioned his record. He hid in a bathroom and then left. Some in the media accused the students of being professional provocateurs. So 131 of them made a YouTube video showing their student IDs to the camera. Soon, through social networks like Facebook and Twitter, a movement called Yo Soy 132, I'm number 132, emerged of those who didn't accept Peña Nieto's candidacy. He was said by them to represent a return to the old authoritarian ways. He was said to get fawning coverage from the major media. Large marches of tens of thousands were held in protest, not in favor of a particular candidate, but against what Peña Nieto represented. For a couple of brief weeks, the sense of inevitable victory around his campaign was shattered. And then, of course, a few weeks later, he won anyway. López Obrador of the left-wing PRD came in second, about 6 points behind, a much wider margin than what he lost by in the 2006 election, which was less than 1%. But yet he still cried foul, citing some of the same reasons as the Yo Soy 132 group, complaining of media imposition of Peña Nieto and of some instances of vote buying by the PRI. There were many worries to come out of the election. First, there was really no candidate that fully deserved an affirmative vote. They were all problematic in different ways. Second, 12 years after its peaceful transition to democracy via the ballot box, a plurality of Mexicans voted to return the party that operated the old authoritarian system to power. Deeply troubling. Third, the major issue facing Mexicans today, which is, well, at least one of them, security, was scarcely an issue on the campaign trail. Fourth, a second-place candidate, though he had clearly received fewer votes than his rival, refused to concede the elections again. Some of his criticisms of the process were correct, but the fact remains that there are probably no elections in the world that would meet a standard that he would accept as legitimate. Fourth, the social movement that emerged from the election, Yo Soy 132, mobilized people without effect on the outcome of the elections. And it also attacked the independent governmental body that oversees Mexican elections, one of the most professional and precious institutions to prevent fraud and ensure a fair electoral process that the country has. It is difficult to avoid the conclusion that Mexican democracy is in worse shape than it was prior to the election. What about the United States? We, too, of course, are in the middle of a depressing campaign, and some of the similarities with the situation in Mexico are instructive. In the time that we have, I can discuss only a few of the reasons to be saddened by the state of democracy in the United States, but let's concentrate on those that have direct bearing on the campaign. One reason for despair has certainly been the way that blatant falsehoods have made their way into mainstream political discourse. The most notable of this was the Republican claim repeated in advertising that Obama had gutted the work requirements and welfare programs. It was found to be not just a little false, but really quite false by an array of fact checkers. Nevertheless, the ad kept running because it was effective, prompting responses along the lines of, "We're not going to let our campaign be determined by fact checkers from the Romney camp, especially with respect to our most effective ad." Whether or not it was a race-baiting attempt to paint Obama with the brush of taking from the makers and giving to the moochers, I can't quite say, but the combination of race animosity and the moral universe of Ayn Rand has led the contemporary Republican Party to make this a repeated theme of the election. This was the subtext of Romney's infamous 47% comments. The whole problem reminds me a little bit of the Simpsons joke of a few years ago when they showed a Fox News helicopter. They, of course, are on Fox, but nevertheless had the gumption to show a Fox News helicopter with the motto, "Not racist, but number one with racists." Perhaps the reception matters more than the intention. Now, I think it's worth noting that in case we feel that our democracy is clearly superior to that of Mexico's, it may be in some ways, but that these ads would have all been illegal in Mexico, where the independent electoral agency that I mentioned earlier would have refused to allow them on the air on the grounds of their not being factual. Here, these would be, to put in place such restrictions would be considered violations of free speech, as would any regulations that would force advertisement to get checked for fairness by any kind of independent agency that we would set up. So any action that we would think about wanting to take along those lines would have to be voluntary, making it problematic to think about a way to improve this situation other than punishing people who take these kinds of actions electorally. Now, another worry for this election cycle in the United States, of course, has been the flood of money going to the so-called super PACs, the results of the Citizens United decision made in the Supreme Court. The immediate consequence of that decision was to allow a tidal wave of untraceable political contributions into our political system in a way that initially strongly favored Republicans, who remain the party of the wealthy in all but four states and the party of the super wealthy almost everywhere. The concern here is that in the name of free speech, a situation has been created in which the fundamental principle of democratic governance, that is, that the votes of all citizens should count equally, can no longer hold. Even if we allow that such an ideal could never be achieved, some people are always going to be more persuasive than others, for example, we might hope that the influence of individuals would vary within reasonable limits, perhaps no more than the differences between heights. And that the equation of influence with access to wealth creates a very difficult situation for democracy. Anxious articles appeared in the last few months in places like The New Yorker, noting the number of big Democratic donors sitting on the sidelines and President Obama's unwillingness to do the kind of glad-handing and donor service that rich people forking over tens of thousands of dollars or more to his campaign expected. Now, the blood pressure of Democrats on this issue seems to me to have dropped a bit in recent weeks as the Obama campaign has shown the ability to do strong fundraising of their own directly for him, and the Romney campaign has been finding that there may be some disadvantages to not being able to control the super PAC funds too directly. But even if the parties can fight to a draw on money issues, that doesn't mean that there is no cause for concern. The fact remains that such a situation places both parties in constant need of fundraising and threatens to make the two parties, even more than is already the case, representatives of different segments of elites and different business coalitions. Here I think the work of political scientist Martin Gillens is instructive. He has a book published earlier this year called Affluence and Influence, and there Gillens examines how government action addresses the problems of the people that it governs. His results are quite striking. He found that when policy preferences differ from those of the wealthy, when they differ between the wealthy, the middle classes, and the poor, the opinions of the middle classes and the poor have almost no relationship to the policies adopted. Policies favored by 20% of affluent Americans, he writes, have about a 1 in 5 chance of being adopted, while policies favored by 80% of affluent Americans are adopted about half the time. He cites numerous examples. Trade policy is one of the most obvious, where the affluent favor less protectionism than the middle classes and the poor. Income taxes would be another, where things have become steadily less progressive over the last decades. Not all of the preferences are associated with conservative positions. It's worth pointing out the affluent also reject abortion restrictions at higher rates, and thus far those preferences have also been respected. Because of the kind of data that's available, Gillens' definition of the wealthy is the top 10%, but there's at least some reason to believe that policy is even more responsive to the needs of smaller fractions of top percentages of the affluent. Gillens quotes Justice Brandeis in saying, "We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentration in the hands of a few, but we cannot have both," and argues that his findings call into question the foundational idea that American democracy should be responsive to the preferences of its citizens. We could go on and discuss other flaws in U.S. democracy. There are many, both large and small. One is that, like the silence around security issues in the summer's Mexican elections, there are subjects where urgency is required, but silence reigns, perhaps the most consequential of which, over the long term, will prove to be climate change. More immediately, the creation of the de facto supermajority requirement in the Senate now means that there is little prospect that Americans will grow more satisfied with their dear Congress, because as an institutional arrangement, it allows the party out of power to block the governing agenda of the party in power, even under a theoretically unified government, while waiting for the party in power to be blamed for its ineffectiveness. It's possible that other conditions might make this a poor strategy, better economic conditions, for example, that would boost the popularity of the party in power anyway, but the fact remains that this legislative innovation is an ominous sign for our government's ability to confront the considerable challenges facing us as a nation. We might also spare a word for the voter ID laws promulgated by Republicans to stop the totally non-existent problem of in-person voter fraud while making it more difficult for people without IDs, especially the poor but also the elderly, to vote. Even those of you who are completely satisfied with the candidate that you're supporting in this election, I think, have some reason to be dissatisfied with the character of our political system. So, just as with Mexico, there are reasons for concern in the United States. And let us now turn our attention to the question of what democracy is and perhaps what it isn't. I think that if you polled 10 different people, you might get 9 different answers about what the most important features of a democracy are. And that could be considered a problem, since democracy is supposed to rest on a foundation of public opinion. Now, if one of the 10 people you happened to poll was a political scientist, you might well end up with 12 or 13 total answers, since the political scientist could presumably give you a few. One manner of answering questions about the nature of democracy is by listing desirable characteristics, and perhaps the most famous lister is Robert Dahl. Dahl so despaired of ever locating the meaning of democracy that he decided he would call what we usually refer to as democracy polyarchy, to emphasize the processes of rule by many contending groups, and listed the characteristics of polyarchy as elected officials, free and fair elections, inclusive suffrage, the right to run for office, freedom of expression, a right to alternative information other than that provided by the government, and associational autonomy. Worthy goals all, although the historian in me is reluctant to endorse such an enumeration, because as a historian I would try to be attentive to how the meaning of words and ideas changes over time. And that is certainly the case with democracy, an idea born in opposition to aristocracy. It is both an idea and a form of government shaped by history. And it's probably impossible for the institutions of democracy to ever meet the expectations of the idea, especially because the idea of what would constitute a democracy keeps changing. Though there were many governments that came into being in the 19th century that called themselves democratic, we would consider none of them to be so by today's standard, most obviously because they restricted the franchise to small minorities of generally propertied white men. Historians of the term tell us that it was really not until Woodrow Wilson, and his campaign to make the world safe for democracy, that the term acquired a positive valence rather than a negative one. Instead of asking what characterizes a democracy, perhaps we should ask what principles justify it. If it is something that we believe in, and I think that we should, then we should be willing to ask ourselves why we do so. Here again, there is not unanimity, but I think that we can come close enough for action. Joshua Cohen, for example, has argued that a democracy is, quote, a political society of equals in which the justification of institutions as well as laws and policies addressed to consequential problems involves public argument based on the common reason of members who regard one another as equals. Adam Chaworsky spins it down to 3 beliefs: self-government via representative institutions, equality of all, and liberty for all, though again the meaning of all 3 of these things can change with time. Indeed, as Chaworsky and others have argued, it is fairly clear that though our founders spoke in the same language that we would use today, they created institutions of government that were designed to claim privileges precisely for people like them, and thus to protect private property. We also know that democracy is no panacea and quite compatible with all manner of troubles, from inequality, irrationality, justice, and even violence. But if democracy, and in general, and our democracy in particular, were born in sin, its ideas have been powerful and adaptable. The foundational principles of democratic government, of self-government, equality, and liberty may exist in tension, but they are compelling enough that we can assign them new meanings. At the same time, if they are the logical foundations from which we build the institutions of government, we should be wary if the institutions that we build come to undermine the principles that are supposedly are justified on that basis. The purpose of democracy is not to allow parties to exchange seats in the halls of government, though I don't mean to dismiss that aspect of the system. The purpose of democracy, to make the central argument of my talk today, is to make the moral conditions that justify democracy real. If our understanding of what those ideas mean change, we should struggle to make the institutions of democracy catch up. If our power has become too unequal because of great inequalities in wealth, for example, we should repair public institutions to obviate the most invidious differences of the accident of birth. What we will be doing in taking such actions is to make our democracy possible for years into the future. We should not be surprised to be in a constant state of failure, nor disappointed by it, but neither should we be resigned to it. Our obligation, in my view, is to renew our commitment year after year. We should continue to insist as a matter of principle that everyone has the right to be disappointed by democracy, by which I mean not that we should allow people to be disappointed, but that they're indeed entitled to democracy and also to expect better from it than they will ever, in fact, receive. We should also continue to insist that we do deserve better and to think creatively about the ways in which we might be able to take action to deliver those sorts of results. To put it another way, the moral imperative of democratic life is to create the conditions under which that democracy would be most meaningful. So I will conclude with a couple of suggestions. The first is that those of us who have the luxury to think about topics such as this should be willing to think about the long term rather than focusing so intently on the short term. One thing we should probably all do is to calm down about the current presidential election, for example. Barack Obama used to argue that there were no red and blue Americas, and in so doing offered a way to feel about democracy, like that there was a popular will hiding in there somewhere that only he could see amidst all the rancor and animosity. But if ever a presidency showed that there are indeed red and blue Americas, it was the way that Barack Obama has been treated in office. And the election seems to offer a very stark choice between liberal and conservative visions of American society. The conservative vision in particular has embraced an ideological position influenced by the so-called Austrian economists and by Ayn Rand, particularly in the selection, of course, of the vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan. This is a position which, it must be said, is greatly at odds with the proposals that are actually on offer. It seems to me to be in many ways more for show than in fact. What we're actually talking about and disputing, as if we're the end of all politics, is a few percentage points of difference in spending. Now, I don't mean to suggest that these are insignificant or that the policies don't matter or that your favored candidate being elected wouldn't make the world a better place, especially since so much of government spending is essentially pre-committed to military, health insurance, debt service, and Social Security payments. Even small reductions in the budget could lead to the government being able to do dramatically less. And also because the direction that policy is heading in also matters. We like to feel that things are, if not where we want them to be, then getting better, at least moving in the direction that we would like to see them move. But when this election is constituted as the difference between freedom and tyranny, we're almost certainly committing an error that exaggerates both presidential power and the consequences of this individual election. With that in mind, I think we should be willing to step back and think about longer-run threats to our democracy. One of the greatest, in my view, is, in fact, income inequality, which must be confronted along multiple dimensions. We can't sustain an idea of equal citizenship with alongside such unequal distributions of wealth. But there are more particular cases as well that we could think about. For the Yo Soy 132 movement in Mexico, having diagnosed the unattractive features of a media semi-monopoly, one of the tasks that surely lies ahead is building a compelling alternative media scene. In the United States, the problems of truthlessness in politics that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk is already leading to reevaluations of the practice of journalism among journalists, and in institutions have hired new types of journalists in order to cope with this problem. Perhaps we could take a lesson from our neighbors in Mexico and pressure our candidates to submit advertising to independent evaluators who will inevitably make mistakes but who might, in so doing, prevent larger ones. These are small things, maybe, but other implications are greater. I think the original justification for universal public schooling was that it was necessary to create the kind of citizens who could participate in democratic life, and I think this vision must be restored at all levels of schooling. To make self-government, equality, and freedom possible in general, and these are the foundational ideas of democracy that justify democracy, we need a recommitment to the idea of public goods to which we all have access. Last week, the historian Eric Hobsbawm passed away at age 95, leaving my profession without one of its greatest practitioners. and one of the only remaining practitioners who really lived the 20th century as well as he wrote about it. When news of his death reached me, I was reminded of the text of a lecture that he gave in 2000 titled The Prospects for Democracy. One of the things that he argued in that lecture was that people today face problems which are largely transnational in nature, not confined within national boundaries, like global flows of capital and labor, problems of ecology. Their solution or mitigation will require, he warned in that talk, measures for which almost certainly no support will be found by counting votes or measuring consumer preferences. This is not an encouraging prospect either for the long-term prospects of democracy or for those of the globe. In short, he went on, we face the third millennium like the apocryphal Irishman who asked for the way to Ballynahinch, pondered and said, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. We have, of course, no choice in the matter. And even if everything he says is accurate, the only way we can find out is by making the attempt to make democracy more meaningful. As Jaworski says, in the end, democracy is but a framework within which somewhat equal, somewhat effective, and somewhat free people can struggle peacefully to improve the world according to their different visions, values, and interests. And since that's a path that never ends, and it's all we'll ever have, we have to take some comfort in the journey. So I'll be happy to take questions either about what happened in Mexico this summer, what is happening right now in the United States, or the broader topic of the philosophical foundations of democracy. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our online and radio listeners that they're listening to Patrick Ivor speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on the topic, What is the Purpose of Democracy? Who would like to ask the first question? I'll start. So how anti-democratic do you think the process of, after every census, redrawing the redistricting lines is? I mean, do you think that this is increasing the anti-democratic process or what?
Well, we have a country of some 300 million people. And it seems to me that this has to be both a challenge to the possibilities for democratic representation and also, I suppose, an opportunity for democratic action to exist at multiple levels. At the federal level, I see no alternative but to use the best available data to try and draw boundaries in the ways that, in ways that try to represent the actual conditions of the country. So I don't see anything as especially undemocratic in the redrawing of census lines every 10 years. I suppose in the years prior to the census, you could argue that the allotment of electoral votes is out of alignment with the actual population. Now, in some ways, I think that this is, it's a bit of a misdirection because there's a deeply undemocratic feature of our electoral system, which is to say the Electoral College itself, totally incompatible with the way that we would think about democracy operating today. It so happens that it is a close enough approximation to sort of general tally that you almost never run into problems. But once every century, and we had an election which took place quite recently, of course, in 2000, you do get problems. And the winner of the popular vote doesn't win the election. There's a reasonably clever way to solve this problem. And some states have adopted what are called national popular vote rules. And basically what that is a law that says that once a majority of states when considered in terms of the electoral votes that they possess, pass the same law, this law will go into effect. And the law says that we will, as a state, give all our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. And if that were to occur, because the states are free to choose how they apportion their electoral votes, there's nothing that says that the state has to give all its electoral votes to the candidate who wins that state. They can give them to the candidate who wins the national popular vote. This would get rid of the Electoral College without having to go through more onerous processes. So that seems to me a pretty good idea that would improve at least the functioning of elections in the country at the national level.
Do you know how many states have passed a law like that?
It's just off the top of my head. I think it's 10 or 12. So far there are Democratic states, but once a Republican is disadvantaged by that system, then the other side will join, and that's probably when it would take place. You get enough states that it would be effective. Yeah.
When in world history has democracy? When and where has democracy worked the best in history and in the United States?
The question is when and where in world history and in U.S. history has democracy worked the best. Historians talk about a problem. We talk about presentism, judging the past by the standards of the present, as something that we're not supposed to do, at least when we're talking professionally, because we recognize that people in the past had different values and ideas about what the good was than we do, and we see our job as explaining those views rather than passing judgment on them. Now, we also enjoy passing judgment on them, but it's a bit unprofessional. It's something that's the parlor game aspect of being a historian rather than the professional aspect of being a historian. So I'm not sure that I can answer that question perfectly. I mean, I have my own views about the societies that have done the best job of living up to the standards that I think make democracy reasonably possible. And in my view, those are the Scandinavian so-called social democracies, where equality and freedom coexist without too much trouble. We tend to think in the United States of issues of taxation as issues of freedom, and I'm not sure that's the right way of thinking about them. And there, I think the tension is not observed in quite the same way. So that would be my personal answer. But that's not to say that those societies are perfect places to live, and just like anywhere else that is trying to operate within a democratic system, I think they have political challenges, they disagree with one another, and it's not, you never get to utopian democracy. That's part of the deal, I think.
Okay, instead of thinking about getting into right about democracy, how about a government that is just simply fair?
Mm-hmm.
You know, difference between fairness and democratic. Democratic might not necessarily be fair, and vice versa.
Well, I mean, there is the old, Winston Churchill line that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. There's some wisdom in that. I'm not sure what a government that was premised on the idea of fairness would look like, because one of the immediate problems that you would face would be that people would disagree about what it means to be fair. So then you'd have to set up some kind of mechanism for deciding what fairness was, and maybe one of the ways that you would do that would be to ask people what their opinions were, and maybe you would decide then that you would want to avoid social pressures, so you would make them you know, put their preferences and down on secret ballots, and then all of a sudden you've got something that kind of looks like you've got a democracy. Another way of solving that problem would be to appoint somebody who decides what things are fair, and that person could make decisions that kept him or herself in power for quite some time, and you would have something that we wouldn't want to call a democracy by meaningful sense, in, you know, by the standards that we judge them today, although plenty of people have claimed democratic legitimacy on the basis of representing larger communities. I mean, I think one of the challenges that always faces a democracy is that you understand people to be pluralistic. And that is in some ways quite irritating, because it would really be nice if people agreed to such a degree that we could all align ourselves to a set of priorities on which we agreed. That anytime you try and do that, though, it ends up you end up suppressing dissident opinion and get trapped in sort of information loops that end up taking farther and farther away from public opinion that emerges and that is created by the very situation that you're trying to solve. So I'm not sure what maybe you have other ideas, but I'm not sure what fairness, a government premised on the idea of fairness, would look like. The philosopher John Rawls has, across his many works, has written about justice as fairness, and in fact considers himself as the primary philosopher justifying the form of liberal democratic government, and setting it on solid philosophical foundations that it was not assumed to have before that. Rawls' idea is that we should think about, before we commit to a society, that we're going to not know what position in society we'll have before we're born, say. So we operate behind what Rawls calls a veil of ignorance. You look down on the society below you and you try and, without knowing who you will be, and decide if the system looks like a fair one. And so what Rawls says is that the only kinds of differences that you would allow under such an intellectual arrangement would be differences among peoples that would improve everyone's overall welfare. So not that everyone would be exactly the same, but that there would be substantial equality, but that inequalities that made everyone better off would probably be accepted by somebody from behind the veil of ignorance. Now, from a philosophical point of view, you might ask, well, how do we know how people from behind the veil of ignorance will think about fairness? And that the sort of edifice comes tumbling down. But I do think there is something compelling about the question, and it can be a useful one to think through.
Yes. Well, I would argue the Bill of Rights could be discussed in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
My question, however, is about Citizens United.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us an historical perspective as to what the body politic was thinking when it limited corporate speech compared to what has occurred today when it's considered to be a person with privileges of speech?
So originally, the idea of corporate personhood came about in American jurisprudence around the turn of the 20th century. And the idea was that this was a useful function because you could hold corporate entities responsible in the same ways that you could hold individuals responsible for the actions that they took in the marketplace. I have no idea, not being a lawyer myself, whether this is an idea that is defensible or whether it could have been arranged in another way. But as you say, the idea now has been slowly transformed by the course of 20th and early 21st century law into a place where now corporations arguably have more free speech rights than people do. Corporations cannot be equal to people. For one thing, they can live forever, and none of us will achieve that, I think. So it's a thorny problem that requires us to think very seriously about what our commitments are within the framework of a democratic system. If we say that corporations don't have speech, how do we decide what groups of people gathered together do have speech, do have access to free speech rights? And I think that one of the most compelling solutions to this problem is to simply say that, although not a very practicable solution, at least in the short term, that these huge inequalities of wealth and access probably shouldn't exist to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. I hope you understand my English. It's not my native language.
Yeah, I understand you fine.
I think there is a direct connection between democracy and public opinion. In the antique Greece democracy, there were two groups who made public opinion: philosophers, politically active philosophers, and sophists. Nowadays, I see only sophists, whereas political active philosophers who can change the public opinion are nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very interesting issue to which I have devoted some thought. There are a couple of things to be said. One is that a lot of political science research in recent years tells us how difficult it is to move public opinion. That everyone is now thinking about the debate performance that President Obama had and that Romney had, and how much is this going to move the polls? Well, we know that something like 45% of people are really committed. Their minds aren't going to be changed by the performance that they see. And indeed, the polling that's come out after the debate, there's one that shows a big bump for Romney, and the others don't show much movement. And the sort of overall picture is that, although almost everyone agrees that Romney had a stronger debate last Wednesday, very few minds were changed. So this literature in political science, which is known as the literature on campaign effects, says that for a variety of reasons, it's very difficult to move public opinion one way or another. As to who might be able to do it and whether or not we have the requisite quality of philosophers, the sort of 20th century analog to ancient Greek philosophers might be people like that we would describe as public intellectuals, right? In the late 1980s, Russell Jacoby wrote a book called The Last Intellectuals, where he argued that the sort of glory days of American public intellectuals were over. The same people were public intellectuals in the 1980s that had been public intellectuals in the 1950s, and that there's a whole sort of missing generation of people who could speak to the public on broad issues of interest from the point of view of their own expertise, but then also being able to address broader concerns in ways that were compelling. I think that one of the reasons, he cited two basic reasons for this. One was the decline of bohemias as they became more expensive places to live, and the other was the rise of academia, that increasingly people who would have been public intellectuals were becoming professors and writing mostly for each other in ways that were obscure and difficult to understand and not of interest to a general public, or not even trying to be convincing to a general public. I think that the interesting question is how much impact the internet has made Jacoby's theses from the 1980s obsolete. I think today we do have a pretty robust conversation among intellectuals, at least in certain corners of the internet. And somebody like Paul Krugman at the New York Times or some of the other columnists for the New York Times seem to me to be in that style of the 20th century public intellectual. Now, it's interesting that they've moved from being philosophers to mostly social scientists, and in particular economists, who you would think might have taken something of a beating in public estimation because of what's happened in the economy over the last few years and their inability to comment on it in ways that seemed intelligible. But, you know, they do math that people don't understand, and I think that kind of mysticism gives them a kind of power over over minds that is quite beguiling. So we'll have to see whether they move public opinion or whether the key thing that public intellectuals do insofar as they're speaking to relatively limited publics is really operating at the level of moving elite opinion in different ways. It's probably more how Krugman works than by moving public opinion.
I had another professor from Stanford, Professor Fishkin, here about a year and a half ago. I'm sure some of you heard him. He was speaking about deliberative democracy, and he's done a lot of this research in the area of how much can you move opinion.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me, some of the research that he had done was in areas for companies where they can use it for advertising. Will people actually be affected by what I do or not? Because can we change people's opinion about this? And he did a very fascinating series of studies for. Are you familiar with this work?
No.
So that's all. I just think he was applying. You know, he would do a poll on people for anything, and he was doing it on California, the California economic crisis, and that's why he came to speak here. And then he would take the people that did the poll, and he would take them in for a weekend and give them all the information as objective information about the issues as he could, and then re-poll everybody to see who has moved their opinion based on information. And there are some topics that there's no movement at all, even after that.
Yeah. I mean, the more people know about things, the less they move when you introduce new information. But there was a question over here that I wanted to get to, and then we'll move over to the other side of the room. Yes.
Do you think our democracy would be more effective if we had a parliamentary system?
The short answer to that is yes. I do. I do think that we would have a more effective democracy if we had a parliamentary system, because I think that it would solve that filibuster problem that I was referring to earlier, where where one party can block the agenda of a party that is supposed to be the majority party. I think that democratic institutions suggest that we should allow the party that is elected to implement its agenda, and if that agenda proves unpopular, then the mechanism that fixes the problem is the next election. That makes a lot of sense to me, and it would, I think, make many things about politics in this country at least more tolerable to watch. Now, I actually think, I mean, there's all this literature over the course of the 20th century. There's historians trying to figure out, well, why is the United States so different from Europe in the sort of social policy programs that you have in place? And, you know, there are 10 or 15 explanations that people put forward. And sometimes I wonder if it wasn't just the existence of the filibuster, and if you had a different sort of institutional structure, if we wouldn't have national health care and more robust social insurance, wouldn't have had them a long time ago. I don't know how we get there from here. I don't know how we get to a more parliamentary-style system. I mean, the reason that the party system that we had worked at all was the weird division of the parties where prior to the Voting Rights Act and the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, there were divisions between the Democratic Party was a coalition of basically Northern liberals and Southern racists. And that meant that you couldn't have party unity on the same grounds that you would expect in a parliamentary system where you expect people to vote in party blocks. So things functioned a bit better than they perhaps ought to have done if the parties were less ideologically aligned. But the process, the historical processes that have been working themselves out over the last 30, 40 years have been towards ideological coherence within the parties. And now we've got a problem because we don't have a parliamentary system. That makes a lot of sense to me.
The example of the filibuster from 1948, I believe, may have been right on point of your history that you just described right now, as you described it in your opening remarks, a standoff of views about the poll tax.
Mm-hmm.
But this problem of, I'm not sure of the technical term of closure, this problem we have today where there is this artificial arrangement of not allowing a majority vote in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
is a somewhat of akin to the filibuster problem, but in a different skin, so to speak. And it's not, I really don't understand what the acquiescence or the reticence of the Democratic members are to be so unable to throw this off. Is it because they're, in a sense, anticipating that they wouldn't do it when they're in the majority in order to protect themselves when they're in the minority, and they've made that bargain?
I think that's one possibility. The other thing is that the institution of the filibuster gives any individual senator an extraordinary amount of power. So whether one is a Republican or a Democrat or not, if you eliminate the institution of the filibuster and you're a senator, you have less influence over policy than you had before. I mean, just think about the way that the healthcare debate went in, I guess, 2009, when the Democrats briefly had 60 votes in the Senate. But they really needed to get, you know, Ben Nelson from Nebraska. So they had to lard up the things to make sure that Ben Nelson was satisfied because he was worried, as one of the more conservative Democrats, about what would happen if he supported the bill. Oh, and then you needed, you know, Joe Lieberman because blah, 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 blah. So because any single defection would torpedo the whole thing, any one person had a huge amount of influence over the outcome of the, because they needed that 60th vote. If you only needed 50 votes, then who cares if you're the 53rd person, 54th person? It just, you remove, well, the history of the filibuster is very confusing. It's not in the Constitution, and it seems to have sort of sprung up in the early years of the Republic almost as a quasi accident. It's a history that I don't understand particularly well from a legal point of view. The way I understand is that at the beginning of each new congressional term, it's possible to rewrite the laws with a majority vote. So it would be possible for Democrats, if they are a majority in the Senate, or Republicans, if they are a majority, to rewrite the rules and eliminate the filibuster. Or you could pass some kind of deal where people agree not to use it in the way that they currently do. And I understand that Harry Reid, who's, of course, the current majority leader, has expressed some interest in this for the upcoming election cycle. But, you know, one only knows if the reforms would be thoroughgoing or whether they would be quite modest, and what the effects of them would be, I think, remains to be seen. But I do think that you're right that part of it is that the Democrats want to use these tools when they are, you know, someday in the minority, but also the fact that it would weaken the influence that each individual senator would have over policy are the principal barriers to action there. We have time for one more question.
This is a specific question. What sort of campaign finance regulation exists in Mexico? How does it compare to our country?
It's a good question. So campaigns in general are much more tightly regulated in Mexico, and the funding that goes to the campaigns is public funding. So they basically have full public funding of the campaigns. Now, I mentioned a little bit earlier in my talk that there are these that's very small party affiliated with a very corrupt teachers union that deserved to lose its registration. One of the perverse consequences of having full public funding of elections is that you get these micro-parties that, by allying themselves with one of the major parties or by running the best candidate, as they did in this last election, in the views of a lot of people, just so that he could get that 2%, so that you keep your registration, there's a kind of slush fund aspect to the public financing that you get, in addition to the positive features of avoiding quite the same corrupting influence of money within the elections. You also get a different kind of corruption where the small parties compete to qualify for the public money. So I don't think that there's any there's no way to move the influence of money completely out of politics. It's just a matter of picking one's poison and trying to live as best we can within the rules that bind us. But you can always take a look at the laws that you have at any given moment and try to improve on them, as I think will probably take place in Mexico to deal with the problem that I just mentioned, and probably won't happen in the United States because our democracy is considered too consolidated in many ways for people to think about reforming it at a very deep level.
That's a perfect way to come to an end of another event at the Commonwealth Club of California. In its 110th year of enlightened discussion, I want to thank Patrick Iver for a great talk on the purpose of democracy. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you very much.